Becoming a software developer is a never-ending journey. Some developers started coding when they were kids. Some ended up studying computer sciences. Others came from very different backgrounds. Some taught themselves programming. Others went through apprenticeship programs. A few even jumped in via boot camps. One thing is sure though, no journey is void of bumps, forks, and hard decisions. Every journey is unique and full of learning that are worth telling. So let's ask developers from all around the world how they got where they are today, how they learn, and how they grow. Whether you are a junior dev, starting your career and learning the ropes, or maybe a senior developer pushing and guiding others around you, we have something for you. Welcome to the Software Developers Journey Podcast. Hello and welcome to Developers Journey, the podcast shining a light on developers' life from all over the world. My name is Tim Bourguignon, and today I receive Harry Roberts. Harry is an award-winning consultant performance engineer from the UK. He has a client list ranging from the United Nations, Google, the BBC, and the Financial Times, and he has helped some of the world's largest organizations make their websites faster. Harry is also an experienced international speaker, and in fact, we met at a conference last week in Estonia. Harry, I'm very pleased to finally get to record your developer's journey. Welcome on the podcast.
Hey, Tim, thank you so much. What a nice intro. It was nice to meet you in Estonia, albeit briefly. It was a nice place to meet.
It was. So tell us, how did you become a developer and how did you grow into this this performance niche you talked about at the TopConf? Tell us your story.
Wow, yeah. So I've been a developer professionally for 10 years now, and then sort of in total, I'd say maybe 12 or 13 years. And I got into development much like I think a lot of people. I got into development by accident. When I was about sort of, I think maybe 14, 15 or 16 years old, I wanted to be a really badass graphic designer. Me and my best friend at the time, we were convinced we were going to be the best designers the world had ever seen. So we just started doing logos and flyers and small bits of work for local companies. Looking back on it, really bad work. Like we were 16 years old. We weren't exactly going to be in the Museum of Modern Art or anything, but we were having fun. We were really enjoying it. And at one point I decided that, wow, we're so good at this that we ought to have a website so people can find us. And I volunteered myself to learn HTML, CSS, little bits of JavaScript to put a little website together. And that was around 2005, perhaps. And it was during that I realized that I much preferred development to design, and I was much, much better at development than I was at design. So I had a natural kind of shift where I got more and more interested in really simple HTML, CSS, like little websites. So we built our portfolio, and then we got our first client. We built their business website. And that was when I was about 16, I guess, was when I fully got into development. And it all started from there, I guess. Very much by accident, but a happy accident. And it's been something I've enjoyed enough to keep doing it for the next 12 years now. And then for the last 5 years, I've been working completely sort of for myself, self-employed for 5 of the 10 professional years.
Mm-hmm. How did you decide to go freelance or to build your own company?
This is a huge answer in itself. So rewinding a little bit. So I've been working for myself for the last 5 years, but going way back to when I first started development at all, I was a teenager. When I was 17 years old, I purchased the domain name cssWizardry.com, which I regret because now it's followed me around for a decade. 11 years now. cssWizardry.com is 11 years old. But at the time I was 17, I had the confidence and the arrogance of a 17-year-old boy. So I just thought, oh, I'm amazing at this. I'm going to start a blog because I'm learning CSS and the whole world needs to learn CSS as well. And I'll be the person who teaches them that. And I did. When I was 17, I started blogging, started writing about new features. It was kind of 2007, so it was the sort of peak of the web standards movement. There was a huge market for people learning CSS. I think CSS Tricks was founded in the same year. So I just started blogging, which meant that, you know, from 2007 onwards, I was beginning to get my name out there. That ended up helping me secure jobs. I think anyone listening who is wondering, you know, should I have a blog? Maybe I should start a blog. Every developer should have a blog. Just fact. It's the single biggest thing in my career that's helped me along. It's just having that documented record of what I've learned, what I've shared. So this blog led to people getting in touch to do speaking. So I got my first ever speaking engagement through my blog. I just ended up getting a bit of a reputation, I guess. And then people started wanting to get me to speak at more and more events. And then I started working at a large organization in 2011, a place called Sky here in the UK. And I believe they are now, like, you know, venturing further and further into Europe. When I started working at Sky, I was working on large scale user interfaces, so big front end builds. And that's when I really got into CSS architecture and realized that very few people had written about CSS architecture. Very few people had done any research about CSS architecture before. So it was a really great time for me. Everything I was writing about was kind of brand new, sort of pioneering or inventing a lot of techniques, or taking techniques that people like Nicole Sullivan had written about and sort of making those a bit more, spreading them further. So after years and years of blogging and being kind of very much in the public eye, I started getting requests to actually do work for people. Like, you know, can you help us with this? Or can you come and run a workshop about CSS? And I had to keep saying no to everything. I was like, I can't, I've got a full-time job. I'm not allowed to do freelance work. And after a while, and a number of other things happened around the same time, but after a while I realized that I have said no to so much work that maybe I should be in a position where I'm saying yes. If I'm getting all these inquiries and requests, then maybe there's actually a market for me out there as a freelancer. I kind of quit my job at Sky and began working for myself. And at the time, I didn't really know what that was going to look like. I didn't have a plan that I was going to do freelance work, or if I was going to do consultancy work, or if I was going to do shorter contracts. I really wasn't sure what that would look like. And I was very fortunate that it kind of happened organically. I steered myself towards a consultancy kind of role where I would help typically quite large companies work out, you know, how do they manage big UI builds? How do they manage big design refactors? So it was actually quite, even though the moment I decided to work for myself was quite sudden, I sort of one day decided that, nope, it's happening. I'm going to work for myself. Actually working out what that looked like was very organic, and that fell together just as I was interested in what I wanted to do. And I'd work out kind of, well, I kind of like doing this, I like the travel, I like speaking. And one really sort of important part of my journey there, one kind of specific moment that I remember is, in fact, there are a couple of moments, and I'll go through all of them actually, because there'll be some interesting things for the show notes. I was working at Sky, fantastic company to work for, really, really great. They had such a good engineering ethos. The quality of development was very high. And I learned a lot working at that company. But they were very sort of programming and back-end focused. So I was the only real front-end developer there, which meant I was really, really busy the whole time. The whole time I was just trying to keep up with about 100 software engineers. And I grew a bit disillusioned. I was a bit kind of on my own. I was a bit of an orphan inside the company. I didn't really fit in with the design team. I didn't really fit in with the programming team, so I was always a bit kind of alone in that company. But I did learn a tremendous amount working there. So I was already getting a bit disillusioned. Then around the same time, I saw a remarkable talk by James Victoire at Beyond Pelerand in Düsseldorf. And I was sat watching this talk, and we should definitely put a link to this in the show notes, but I was sat watching this talk, and James Victoire was talking about how, you know, whenever you're working for somebody else, you can never really achieve your true potential because you're working for somebody else. And I was sat watching this talk thinking, there are 500 people in this room, but I feel like he's speaking just to me, right? It was a very poignant moment. So I got on the flight back from Dusseldorf thinking, wow, like I think I know what I need to do now. And me and James have kept in touch for the last sort of 5 years, and he's very aware of the role he played in my sort of self-employed career. Then I got back to England and I made two lists. I got one sheet of paper and I drew a line straight down the middle of it. And on the left-hand side, I wrote down everything that I am able to do. So I can build websites. I can do public speaking. I can write. So I've been blogging for sort of 6 years by this point. I wrote down everything that I could offer anybody. I can do training. I can do development work. I can do whatever it was that I was capable of doing as a job. I wrote down just a list of all those things. On the other side of the piece of paper, on the other side of the line, I wrote down everything that I want out of a fulfilling job. So I want kind of recognition. Everybody wants that. Everybody wants to feel like they made a contribution. Everybody wants to feel like they made a change. I wanted to travel. I decided that, well, if I could potentially travel as part of my work, that's a very, very privileged and fortunate position to be in. I wanted autonomy. I wanted to make a difference. And I wrote down everything that I wanted. And I didn't write money anywhere. I didn't write, you know, I want to be rich. Because if anyone wanted to be rich, I would not advise becoming a developer. But I did. I wrote a list of all the things that I want out of a fulfilling job. And my task then was to look at these two lists and work out, well, how can I turn the left-hand side into the right-hand side? How can I tie the ribbons together between these two lists and sort of create the job that I wanted? And yeah, I went ahead and did it. I'm a very privileged person. You know, I've got a lot going right for me. I've got, it's interesting. I've got a lot of support, I guess. You know, I've got a family who could have looked at, my parents could have lent me some money if it had gone wrong, or, you know, I had a lot of different safety nets. I didn't use any of them. I didn't need to borrow any money to start my freelance career. I didn't need to worry too much. But one thing I did have that was, it turned out to be a very, very useful thing, is I had a 3-month notice period at Sky. Now, what that means is I had to tell Sky 3 months in advance that I wanted to leave my job. And what they did is every senior member of staff, I was a senior developer at Sky, every senior member of staff had this 3-month notice period, so that, yeah, if you wanted to quit your job, you had to give them a quarter of a year's notice. And most people are terrified by that, because if you go to job interviews and the interviewer asks you, cool, and how soon could you start? And you have to tell them, oh, I can't start for 3 months. That's normally a really bad thing. Mm-hmm. But luckily what happened to me is I was thinking, well, I want to work for myself, but I'm not really sure what that's going to look like. But because I had 3 months to work out, I just quit my job. I didn't actually know what I was going to do next. I just quit, and then it gave me a 3-month deadline to work out. And two good things about this is it gave me a deadline. If I hadn't quit my job, I maybe would have never got around to it. I would have just thought, oh, I'll think about that tomorrow. The moment I quit, the clock started ticking. I had 3 months to work this thing out. Then the other great thing is, normally, if you've got a 3-month notice period, you have to go to interviews secretly, right? You have to go to interview secretly. You have to tell your manager that, oh, I need to go to the doctors, but really you're going for a job interview. I didn't have to do that. I just quit my job, and then I could look for things very publicly. I didn't have to keep anything a secret. So I was very tasteful. I wasn't just leaving the office to go and have meetings with other people, but I told my manager that I was intending to leave, and I was going to leave in 3 months. But for that next 3-month period, I was able to tweet, hey, I'm self-employed now. Like, you know, in 3 months, I'm starting to accept work. And it gave me like this quarter of a year period where I was still getting a paycheck from Sky. Sky knew full well that I was intending to leave, so it was all official. But it also gave me 3 months to queue up new clients. It got me 3 months to find new work. And it also gave me 3 months to work out what that was all going to look like. Mm-hmm. So my advice to anyone who's considering leaving a job, you might look down and think at your contract and think, well, I've got a 1-month notice period. That gives me a month to sort everything out. What you've got to remember is that 1 month is a minimum. So you could give your boss 3 months notice. You could say to your manager, hey, look, I know you only need 1 month's notice, but just to let you know that in 3 months, I intend to start working for myself. And with that 3 months, you get a guaranteed paycheck from your employer for that 3 months, but you also get a bunch of time to start exploring or start discussing things without having to hide it. And that was huge, because it meant that by the time I actually left the office on my very last day at Skype, I knew the very next day that I had work to do for another client. I had meetings lined up. I had travel to different conferences already organized. And that was a huge thing that I didn't really consider at the time to be that valuable. But looking back on it, having that period of that kind of that window of public availability was really useful. So that's one thing I've advised a lot of my friends and peers mm-hmm. is that, look, you might have a 1 month notice period, but make it three. Just, you know, take the time to do things properly. And that was a huge part of it.
Cool. Wise words. Thank you. How picky were you able to be at the very beginning? I mean, now you have created a niche for yourself, but how was it at the beginning? Were you able to choose, or did you have to accept almost anything?
So one thing I did is very quickly picked a niche. So my current niche is performance engineering, but before that it was CSS architecture. It's kind of a good idea and a bad idea at the same time. I decided to focus really heavily on CSS architect, which meant my JavaScript suffered, so that nowadays my JavaScript is really weak. I would never be hired to do any JavaScript work because of the opportunity cost of focusing on CSS so much. But it meant that my first clients when I worked for myself were, I could be very picky. They were always exciting. So I had inquiries from one of my first ever clients was the Financial Times, which is, it's my favorite newspaper. They got in touch with me and I couldn't believe it. It was incredible. And that was purely because of having a niche. So it meant that if people needed CSS architecture, they could only really come to me because the only other people writing about it at the time were fully full-time employed. So I was able to be quite picky. But then also at the same time, I'm not a very picky person. I will work with any company as long as they're enthusiastic and seem like nice people. My client list that I have on my website is very much to try and, oh, and here's another thing, right? Being self-employed, you have to be shameless with self-promotion. And I tend to be quite good at that. So the client list I list on my website is always, oh, big clients. And it's meant to impress people. And it's meant to try and give me that credibility. But I work with tiny, tiny clients. I work with basically anyone who wants to do good work together, anyone who wants to do something meaningful and really cares about their craft and their profession. So actually, one of my very first clients, he may have actually been my first client, was a guy called Marcus, who lives just outside of Frankfurt. He lives in a place called Kronberg. And it was literally, he was self-employed, and he was one person who hired me as one person. We just went to his house and hacked on CSS architecture for 3 days together. So at the beginning, I worked with a single person company, and then about a week later, worked with the Financial Times. So although I could have been picky, my benchmark for a good client is just somebody who seems nice, who cares about what they do. And also there's an aspect of because I am so heavily aligned to, at the time, CSS architecture, it was only ever the correct kind of clients that got in touch, if that makes sense. Nobody would think to get in touch with me for design work. Nobody would think to get in touch with me for JavaScript work because I was so obvious and so clear about what I did. It was only really the exact kind of correct client that ever got in touch.
Mm-hmm. And how did you realize and then manage to transition to this performance engineering that you're doing?
Performance is my favorite thing in the world because I started with CSS purely because it fascinated me, and it was the very first kind of bit of coding I ever did, sort of when I was 14, 15 years old, was just CSS, really simple syntax. So I got into CSS through just interest and because it happened to be the first thing I did. But then when I was working at Sky, it was a very high performance application that we were working on. It was actually skybet.com. So in the betting and gaming industry, performance is absolutely vital. And Skybet set up a performance engineering team, but they kept on focusing on server performance or database architecture or very, very back end and infrastructure performance. And me as the only front end developer was sort of saying to them, hey, look, we need to focus on front end performance. Like we need to work out how to make the front end faster. And they were kind of, yeah, maybe, whatever, like maybe, possibly. So I was never officially part of the performance engineering team, but I joined anyway. And I was like, look, while you're looking at servers and you're looking at infrastructure, I'm going to learn about front-end performance. I'm going to research that kind of stuff. And I just found it fascinating because CSS has a huge part to play in front-end performance. So it, for me as a CSS geek, a CSS nerd, getting to learn more about how CSS affected performance and then a bit more about how everything else on the front end affects performance, I just disappeared down that rabbit hole. So I guess since about 2011 onwards was when I was really aware of front end performance. But then it wasn't until about 2 years ago that I officially made the transition to I'm going to focus more on performance engineering. And there's a very, very, very simple reason for that. And I'm going to be completely honest as to the reason why I made an official transition. It was better for business. As a self-employed person, I found it's way better for business to focus on performance than it is on CSS. And the primary reason for that is the CEO of a company, they don't care what the CSS looks like. They don't care if you use Bootstrap. They don't care if you use vanilla CSS. They don't care if you use CSS in JavaScript. But every CEO of every company knows if they've got a slow website, and they understand that slow websites lose money and that fast websites make more money. So from a simple business point of view, I realized that I'd already written about everything I knew about CSS architecture. The CSS in JavaScript movement has started to remove a lot of the problems anyway. So the industry was moving away from traditional CSS. So I just saw a gap in the market. I was like, well, what I did for CSS architecture, there aren't many people doing that for performance. And what ended up happening is I've had way more inquiries. The value of my work has increased quite a lot. The amount I'm able to bill clients has gone up dramatically because it's very rare that better quality CSS will lead to more sales, right? It's very unlikely that a company will see more zeros in their bank account because they had better clear fixes than their competitors. But with performance, it's a real business-facing metric, and it's been way more meaningful for me. The work that I'm doing for clients has a more direct impact on their business. I get to have discussions with people more senior. So it would be a case of I was sat having a meeting with the chief financial officer of NBC Universal a couple of weeks ago. A surreal moment. But you know, when I was doing CSS consultancy, the CFO of NBC Universal doesn't even know what CSS is. But because I was there to fix their website and make it faster, they took an interest. So I had a meeting with this super high up dude about web performance. So from a business point of view, it's been a really, really good move for me. And also, it's just fascinating. I think every developer agrees that if you can measure it, it can always be better. And developers like making things better. We like making things faster. So it's just a good nerdy kind of pastime as well, just to focus on how fast can we make this.
Mm-hmm. How did your rebranding go? I mean, you've been focusing on CSS for a while, and then suddenly you had to switch a bit from one foot to the other. Did that go smoothly? How did that go?
That's a really interesting question because I haven't actually rebranded, so I'm still called CSS Wizardry. Which has led to interesting things. If you hit my site for the first time ever, you don't know who I am, you've never heard anything from me before, you hit my website, it's called CSS Wizardry. So it's really hard for me to sell performance through that name. So what I focused on is actually doing talks about performance. So I'm trying to do more public activity around performance and less about CSS. So you and I met in Tallinn, Estonia, right? Mm-hmm. I've got a really nice client out in Tallinn, wonderful, wonderful client. But the first time I ever worked with them, it was a little bit awkward because they had a website that was really, really slow, and they wanted me to work out why. But it became a bit of an awkward situation when I had to turn up in their office and say, hey, I've been looking at your website for a week, and here's why it's slow, and telling all the developers that they'd effectively built a slow website was a very awkward discussion to have. And one guy... a really talented engineer, very kind of problem-solving, kind of just a very talented engineer. Me and him went for a few beers midweek, and he was like, Harry, I've got a bit of a confession. I thought that you were just going to come in and say, your CSS needs this, and this CSS is the problem, and this is all CSS-based. And he thought my job was only to know about CSS because he went to my website, and it's called CSS Wizardry. And he said he was really pleasantly surprised that I wasn't just there to tell him about CSS, that I did know other things as well. But it's a thing that I'd never heard from someone before, because I haven't rebranded, because I am still called CSS Wizardry everywhere. I think a lot of people don't realize that my work has changed. And I'm not entirely sure how to solve that problem because I can't afford like a big, big companies do rebranding exercises. A lot of people don't know my name at all. They just know CS Wizardry. So I've never actually fully rebranded. I don't know how that would go. I wish I could because I hate the name CS Wizardry. I hate it.
Oh, I wonder how you could do that.
Maybe just register performancewizardry.com.
Yeah, or jump on the on the NoSQL, so not only SQL bandwagon, and do a no CSS wizardry with not only CSS wizardry.
I might buy that domain after this podcast.
Yeah. You haven't seen January to do this. Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I've been pondering with the same idea. I'm very into mentoring and coaching and helping people, and I'm considering starting a side gig on my own. And this is a very hard idea to decide on. Is how can I call this thing to be a message to the clients and the person that I will be interacting to, but also leave a door open for the future. And because my answer to what I want to do right now is not necessarily the answer that will stick. And this is really hard, man.
Yeah. I mean, I wish when I was 17, I'd been, well, not 17, I guess, because yeah, I didn't realize at the time, if you call yourself CSS Wizardry, that's a fairly strong indication that you do CSS. Mm-hmm. And now I see it all the time in different brands that pop up in the real world, like physical shops. They call themselves after the street they were based on. And it's like, well, you can never move your business now. I've got a co-working space, a really wonderful co-working space called Duke Studios. And that's because they used to be based in a building on Duke Street. Now they had to move building to somewhere completely different, and they're still called Duke Studios, and nobody knows why. Like, why is it called Duke Studios? Oh, they used to be on a building. They used to be in a building on Duke Street. Oh, okay, that makes sense. And it's like, I just wish I hadn't called my business something. And all the domain names are gone now as well. So even if I did pick a better name, I probably couldn't get the .com. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's one of those things where if I was to found a new or different company, I would try really hard to name it after something non-specific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting.
You mentioned mentoring and the idea that you might want to start being a mentor to people. Do you know what that would look like? Because I'm considering the same thing for the new year. I'm thinking about perhaps taking on mentees. But do you mind if I ask you a question about about your mentoring or your thoughts? What do you think that would look like for you?
So I have to dissociate two things. I've been a mentor and a mentee for the past 5 years now. So it's mm-hmm. already something I do. What I'm after right now is how could I start more like a business around it? I don't want mentoring to be a business because mentoring mm-hmm. is for me, it's not coaching. It's not something that you really make a business out of, but I want to promote mentoring as a thing. And so I've been doing keynotes for events. I've been doing talks in companies to try and promote this idea of mentoring inside the company. And this could be a business.
Yeah.
I'm still not completely sure how that could become a sustainable business, something that they could do full time. So it's going to be a side gig for a while. I'm creating right now an email course to get people into this idea. I'm still still doing keynotes and stuff like that. So I'm still not sure how that could work out, but I would like to encourage people to care about each other, help each other, and really get into this human relations of things. I'm kind of sad when I see all those MOOCs, so those online platform classes and everything being the answer to how do you learn today. Of course, this is one of the answers, but did you get all the, is this class that you're taking on Pluralsight or whichever platform that is, the right answer for you? Is this, did you drill down, the question enough? Did you get enough help to know that this 50 hours class that you're going to take is right for you? And I think this is only something you can drill down with the help of somebody else. And once you have the answer, once you know this is the answer I need, then you can put the effort. But there's a lot to do beforehand. And this has been, in my experience, very effective things to do with a mentor. I'm trying to promote this. And the relationships I built with mentees and my mentors, and the depth we've reached, almost deeper than friendship sometime. It's really amazing what happens when you really truly care about people and start interesting yourself and just be there for people. And so I would like everyone to experience this. And I'm sure there's a business idea behind it, but how does it really look like? I'm not sure yet.
Well, it'd be fun working that out, but I just want to say that's really admirable of you. I really like that you do definitely seem to care a lot, and that's really nice. You don't see that much anymore.
Well, thank you.
Plus, also, I don't know how you've got time for speaking, your regular job, a podcast, and mentoring. That's insane. You really do care, don't you?
Yes, I do. And this is also a thing for myself. I get out so much from those discussions. You know how when you hold a training, you know you're the expert about something, and then somebody starts poking at one idea, and you realize, oh boy, I had never considered this thing from this angle, and now I'm unsure.
Yeah, I love that because, everyone can teach somebody something, right? Every single person in the world can teach anybody else at least one thing. And, in trainings, in workshops, is where it becomes really apparent because, someone asks you a question, and you're like, shit, I don't actually know the answer to that. And my usual thing is, well, let's research it together. And we'll start picking it apart and working out, oh, right, it's this, this, and this. And I leave thinking, sweet, I learned something from that person. They didn't necessarily intend that. Or sometimes, actually, they do just tell you that, oh, it works like this. And I'm like, that's great. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. So, this is one of the reasons I want to maybe start doing mentoring. I need to work out what that would look like. But it's because people younger than I or people more junior than me, they will know different things. They'll know things that I don't know that I don't know. So I might be able to help someone with career advice, or if they're wanting to start freelancing, I can help them with how to find clients or how to set a pricing strategy. But that person will be able to tell me that, oh, right, well, in Vue, you just do this, this, and this, and then this works. And I'll be like, oh, sweet, because, there's every chance that someone more junior than me will know more about a specific framework, because it's not my job to know. So I'm really fascinated by the two-way aspect of mentoring.
Absolutely. I take something out of every meeting, mentoring meeting I have, each and every one of them. It's a win for myself in the first place. So if I'm able to give somebody else something, then it's bonus. But it's amazing.
Yeah. It's a nice dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I would advise, if I may, is not trying to get into mentoring. I love this analogy about dating. You wouldn't get in a first date and start talking about marriage. So
right.
What you're after is a connection. You're after chemistry. You're after someone with whom you want to spend more time with. And this is exactly how a mentoring relationship starts for me. Let's start talking together. Let's see if we have a common ground. Let's see if we want to talk more, if we want to interact more with one another. Do we have the same kind of problems in mind? Can I help you with something? Can you help me with something? And if this grows, then it will probably grow into a mentoring relationship. And at the beginning, such a mentoring relationship is often unbalanced. So there's more like a mentor and a mentee. And if it evolves well, it will balance itself with more like a sparring partner relationship. And this can take a few years to get there. But once it reaches this real balance, it's amazing what comes out of it. So I'm the mentor for this topic and you are the mentor for this one. And you can just go back and forth depending on the on the time of the year, on the topics at hand, and what's happening in our lives. And having those people in your life is just a six or seven gear or new tools in your toolbox. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's one thing I was considering, is how do I find the people to mentor? Because it'd be a very cold and sterile start if I was just to have a form on a website somewhere. So I guess it needs to happen more organically and then present itself as a mentor-mentee relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I try to do is with every relation that I have, every interaction that I have with someone, I try to feed the fire. Meaning, try to leave some questions unanswered. Try to hint at some meta level that could be behind the answers we already gave. So hinting there is more to this topic, and then I see if the people come back. If they come back, that means they're interested in this stuff, and then I can continue feeding the fire and see the fire keeps burning. And usually after a while, we realized we're having a lot of fun going back and forth and philosophizing about things and exchanging ideas. And this is when the mentoring relationship really starts. It's at some point realize, oh, okay, we're having fun like this. We should be doing this more. We should continue doing this. And I actually put the mentoring name behind it only when I want to invert the pull and push mechanism. So meaning at the beginning, I'm more in a push stance, meaning I try to feed the fire. And when I see that this is going, then I will introduce this idea. Actually, what we're doing is mentoring. And now I would expect you to pull. So I'm here. If you need me anytime, if I need you, I will pull as well. But I would like you to pull now. And so this means I'm able to take more mentees, because I'm not the one doing all the work and pushing.
Yeah.
And so I've experienced with having three or four mentees at the same time. This is my very maximum limit. Three is better than four. Three is really, really not exhausting, but tiresome. But it still works, and now I have more mentees that have been with me for years now, and we still see each other less regularly, but still regularly, and still for very very sharp topics and very very precise advices, and we still have a lot of fun, and they have grown into a different direction and have their mentees on their own, and it's just a relationship that's continuing, just not as heavily as before. Just they have different interests now, and so this is how it should be going, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, it sounds really great. It sounds like the sort of the most organic and natural way to run things. I like it.
Yeah,
it's given me a lot to think about.
Cool. Let's switch gears a bit and continue on this on this idea. What would you be looking after in a mentee?
What kind of like skills or what kind of passions and that kind of thing? What would I be looking for in?
Yeah, exactly. So
one thing that I do a lot of, I advise a lot of people. So it's never an official mentor role, but a lot of people email me asking for advice. And a lot of people ask things like, should I learn Vue or React? And that's the exact opposite of what I would look for in a mentee. Because that's somebody who, through no fault of their own, but that's someone who's focused very much on short term or focused very much on immediacy. It's also someone who's probably going to burn out real quick because they're just going to keep hopping. And as soon as React goes out of fashion and it's all about Vue, then it will be that's what they focus on. And then they'll always be kind of playing catch up. Mm-hmm. What I look for, if I was to hire someone or if I was to have a mentee, I would always look out for somebody who's not slow paced, but somebody who focuses a little deeper, a little more fundamental. I think, and certainly my consultancy work, the biggest value I provide to every single client is my knowledge of the fundamentals and that simplicity is a feature. So a lot of the time I get hired to fix things where everyone just said, oh, let's go 100% React, or let's go 100% Bootstrap. So whenever somebody asks me like, oh, should I use Bootstrap or Foundation? Should I use Vue or React? That's not the kind of thing I want to help people out with, because that stuff changed all the time. There's no point even asking that question. I would look for a mentee who would ask me things like, hey, so I want to make sure this website lasts for the next several years. What fundamental approaches should I take? How do I need to consider accessibility when I build this? How should I consider resilience as I build this? So for me, I think a valuable trait in developers is to have a more reasoned and considered approach and realize that everything else is just implementation detail. Your use of React or Vue is just implementation detail. It'll give you a lot more longevity in this industry. I've been doing this for 10 years, and I keep going through this, not a crisis of confidence, but I keep going through this panic where I think, oh, I need to learn this thing, I need to learn this thing, I need to learn this thing. And then I realize that I've managed to stay relevant for the last decade by focusing more on fundamentals, by focusing less on trends and new techniques, but more on the unwavering, the principles of how the web works. Mm-hmm. I guess that's a pretty philosophical answer, but I would rather mentor someone who, I wouldn't want to be somebody's outsourced Stack Overflow, I think is the answer. I don't want to be answering questions about, should I use Flexbox or Grid? Because my answer would be, it doesn't matter. The answer changes depending on what you're solving. What you should be asking is, how can I build this reliably, resiliently? How can I make sure it's accessible? How can I make sure X, Y, and Z? So I think that's my general stance. If I was to either look for a mentee or if I was to hire an engineer, I would always look for somebody who understands the fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. This is also what I've been doing. This is the part where I feed the fire. Usually it starts with such low-level questions, and I would be in such a case, I would be in exactly doing this. So the question is Vue or React, and it will start hinting as, well, there is more than this, and this is not the right question, and see if this sparks an idea and a start of an understanding. I don't want to be too picky with my mentees and say, well, you're obviously asking the wrong question. I can't help you. That would be bad to answer. But start hinting as, well, it might not be the right question to ask, and see if they catch up the hint and understand what I mean with this.
Yeah, see if they can work it out.
Yep. And slowly moving to a different direction. But I still think there's, like in consultancy, you need to start where your clients are at and not where you would like to them to be. That's the same with mentoring. You have to catch up first with where your mentee is, and then start pushing. But if you see the potential in such a person, then it should go quite fast and become big and great. But that's also what I'm after. And I'm even after one more thing, which is I want to create mentees that will become mentor, that can have mentees as a that create mentors in their stead. So I want to create an avalanche. Otherwise, I mean, as I said, three mentees at the same time is the most I can do with my time, and it's already a lot. And my years are counted. Even if I still have, hopefully, a lot of years in ahead of me, I will probably never reach 100 mentees. That's a very, very short time and small number. So I need to trigger people that will do this again, like I did it with them. And so I've been picky in this regard, I would say.
No, that's good. So you want to be a multiplier, right? You want to, absolutely, you know, have that network effect. So yeah, it makes complete sense.
Cool. We're unfortunately at the end of our time box.
Oh wow, that's gone quickly.
Yes, it did.
Yeah.
We kind of already answered the question I usually ask about skills. Then guess we should jump on to your upcoming talks and stuff. Do you have something coming up, something on your plate for the beginning of the year?
Nothing specific. It's just more of the usual. I'm really excited. I think the end of January, like 23rd of January kind of time, there is the return of New Adventures Conference. So this was a conference that was really, really highly regarded, and the conference was held when I was just becoming a developer. So I never actually attended this event, but all of a sudden it's back. And I'm really excited to attend New Adventures in the UK at the end of January. But then beyond that, it's client work as usual, and then just speaking engagements in some very exciting places. But I don't have like a, I don't have a book that I'm trying to plug. I don't have like a, you know, an online course that I'm trying to plug. Unless, actually, that's a lie. If you want to learn ITCSS, which is the CSS architecture that I developed a few years ago, me and Skillshare have put together the official ITCSS video course, which you can watch. But other than that, the new year is looking much the same as always for me. Lots of fun client engagements and lots of interesting travel.
Okay. Where could people reach out to you and talk to you?
I would say the best place to find me is on Twitter. My Twitter handle is predictably CSS Wizardry. My DMs are open there, so that's usually how a lot of people do get in touch with quick questions. I try and answer those as quickly as possible. So if anyone does have any questions about, you know, self-employment or performance or anything they would like any advice or help with, that's probably the best place to find me.
Cool. And I will add a link to your website as well in the show notes. So if listeners, you want to reach out, you can also jump on there. Well, Harry, thank you very much. This has been a delight.
Nice. Thank you. It was a pleasure. That was really good fun.
And this has been another episode of Developer's Journey, and we'll see each other in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Dear listener, if you haven't subscribed yet, you can find this podcast on iTunes, Google Music, Stitcher, Spotify, and much more. Head over to www.devjourney.info to read the show notes, find all the links mentioned during the episode, and of course links to the podcast on all those platforms. Don't miss the next Developer's Journey story by subscribing to the podcast with the app of your choice right now. And if you like what we do, please rate the podcast, write a comment on those platforms, and promote the podcast on social media. This really helps fellow developers discover the podcast and those fantastic journeys. Thank you.